Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always a pleasure to be with you to share positive insights how we can live a longer and healthier life. Today, we're going to talk about bilberry. It's good for your eyes. Also, a 100-year-old treatment inhibits COVID-19 infection. Flaxseed beats probiotics for improved insulin sensitivity and altered microbiota. And could probiotics help slow the aging of cognitive decline? Non-alcoholic muscadine wine shows promise of improving aging skin, and a link found between childhood television watching and adult metabolic syndrome. All of this comes from the PubMed, the National Library of Medicine. We begin by looking at something that's rather common but rarely discussed, and that is bilberry extract. Now, bilberry is very positive, always been known to be good for your eyes, but in this case, it may bring tears to your eyes. It's a naturally standardized bilberry extract, improves tear flow in people with dry eyes, which is not uncommon. And dry eye disease, or DED, affects the surface of the eye, creating discomfort and inflammation and visual disturbance. It can also potentially damage the eye. So bilberry extract makes a difference. It's natural, non-toxic, and they have a standardized bilberry extract. It is, let me spell it for you, M-I-R-T-O, that's M-I-R-T-O-S-E-L-E-C-T. And that was shown to improve tear secretion and enhance antioxidant potential. So all good there. So if you have dry eyes, bilberry extract can help. Now, another study, this is from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, studies a 100-year-old treatment that could inhibit the COVID-19 infection. A team of researchers at the institute has eliminated a new possibility for the treatment and prevention of COVID-19 in research published in Communications Biology. The team found that Suramin, S-U-R-A-M-I-N, that's a 100-year-old drug still used for human sleeping sickness that has many other potential applications, inhibits the infection of SARS-2. Quote, Suramin binds to the ACE2 and cell surface heparin sulfate binding sites on the receptor binding domain of the viral spike protein in vitro. Now, that means it neutralizes it. So just one more thing to help prevent SARS, all right? And though it's improving substantially, I don't know about you, but I take a tablespoon of flaxseed oil every day. But you can also take flax seeds, the shelled flax seeds. Why? Because they're rich in the way that the microorganisms in our intestine proliferate in a good way. In fact, they actually are better than probiotics for improving insulin sensitivity in diabetics and also giving you a better bacteria in your gut. This is the University of Copenhagen. A study comparing fibrous flaxseed with probiotics has questioned the latter's ability to alter gut microbiota and to improve obesity-related metabolic disease. The study saw a group of obese postmenopausal women, and they're really challenged in getting rid of that extra weight, given a daily dose of either a 10 grams, that's not a lot, I'll give you an idea, it's 28.35 grams to an ounce, so you're only talking about a half an ounce of flaxseed mucilage, which contain about 30% dietary fibers, or a maltodextrin placebo, and that was done for 6 weeks. The researchers looked at fecal DNA to identify changes in the gut microbiota. They sought to explore the theory that obesity-related metabolic disease were accompanied by alterations in gut bacteria in the gene composition in abundance, and wanted to know, is one type of bacteria better than another? And the answer is yes. This was published in the British Journal of Nutrition. The study found that flax seed altered 33 metagenomic species, including decreasing 8 that are very serious. So just put some flaxseed, improve your insulin sensitivity, especially if If you want a healthier gut, healthier metabolism, it works, all right? Natural, non-toxic. And continuing to discuss probiotics, two studies, the University of North Carolina and North Carolina State University, they did a research and found that probiotics can slow aging-related cognitive decline. Well, anything that is natural, non-toxic, can help with our mental acuity and our cognition is important. And by the way, I'm finding from my own clinical experience that more and more people I'm counseling who are younger, in their 40s and 50s, are having dementia symptoms and or being even referred in one case by a neurologist who doesn't have any ability to help this person. So it does, it's happening because of all the different impact upon our cognition. And a lot of it is when I talk with people, they've had a high complex. Speaking about probiotics, there's a new study from two universities, University of North Carolina and North Carolina State University. And they ask a simple question. Could probiotics help slow age-related cognitive decline? The answer is yes. Findings from a new study suggest that taking probiotics could help prevent the decline in memory and thinking that accompany aging. This research may pave the way for new, non-invasive treatments, natural treatments that leverage the gut microbiome, meaning the good bacteria in your gut, to mitigate cognitive decline in the aging population. And by the way, in my own practice, I see a lot of younger people showing signs of cognitive decline, especially those who had COVID. Just one of the phenomena of it. And there are protocols that can help. So that's good news. And one other piece of good news, there is a grape I grow. And they're purple or green. They're very crunchy and they're delicious. And it's called a muscadine, M-U-S-C-A-D-I-N-E. And they grow down here in Florida. In fact, I have them growing up over a garage. And I just go up and pick a bunch. And they last about a month in a refrigerator, unlike normal grapes that would mold. Very thick skin. Well, turns out the University of Florida did a study of a non-alcoholic wine. There's no alcohol in it. That's good. And it shows promise of improving aging skin. So, could muscadine wine, non-alcoholic, help perk up sagging skin? According to a new study, women who drank two glasses of non-alcoholic muscadine wine daily showed significant improvements in the elasticity and water retention of their skin compared to those who consumed the placebo. By the way, that the study is the first time scientists have studied the impacts of non-alcoholic wine consumption on skin health in a randomized clinical trial. And that's good that they did. Not only, and by the way, muscadine grapes are in season right now. They're only in season once a year at this time, but they're the best of all the grapes, the tastiest, and the mouth feels good, so try them. And by the way, it's right here in southeastern United States, in Florida, where they're used and made into a wine. They're rich in anthocyanins, quercetin, and ellagic acid that can help decrease inflammation, oxidative stress in your body and in your skin. So that's good research, something natural once again and non-toxic. Also from the University of Otago, which is in New Zealand, there's been a link found between childhood television watching and adult metabolic syndrome, heart disease, diabetes, stroke. University of Otago study has added weight to the evidence that watching too much television as a child can lead to poor health in adulthood. The research was done by the Department of Preventative and Social Medicine and published in the peer-reviewed journal Pediatrics. It found that children who watch more television were more likely to develop metabolic syndrome as an adult. And that is really important. I don't know about you, but when I was a child, and I'm sure many of you as well, if we weren't in school too young, we'd go out and play. And we'd play it all over the neighborhood with our friends and build little forts and dig tunnels and everything. And then we'd come back, have our lunch, almost always Well, in my case, it was a Campbell soup, like a tomato soup or a mushroom soup. And then would be a grilled cheese sandwich and a glass of milk. Then we'd run back out again and we'd play. And of course, we'd get bruises and cuts and scratches. It was just normal. And we'd come back in and wash up before dinner. And if it was evening, we'd be out playing kick the can or hide and go seek and these, you know, fun little harmless games. And but keep in mind that back then, we didn't watch television. We didn't have computers. We weren't on cell phones. We actually had friends that we could see each day and talk with and play with. Not so much today. I think that we have overparented in one respect. And depending upon the social and class system that we have in our society, and we do, and it's unfortunate because a lot of the working middle class, they go into debt trying to emulate the wealthier people. And the wealthier people are not role models for anything except, in my opinion, excess narcissism, entitlement, greed, and deeply insecure because they have to have you be aware of everything. See, look at the cereal I'm eating this morning. Oh, I'm just doing fingernail polish. All this stupidity. We didn't do that growing up. And that's why if you were fortunate enough to grow up as a baby boomer or next generation, you're far more grounded. Just saying. In any case, that's the latest on health and healing. Don't forget that I'm doing a classroom on the air, and there's a lot of them I've done. If you're not up on them, go to Gary Noll YouTube, or you can also go to Rumble or Odyssey and download them. They're free. There's a public service. We're going to take a break. Come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. Now to a commentary from Jonathan Turley, T-U-R-L-E-Y. He is one of America's most respected and appreciated constitutional attorneys. He teaches at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And he's written a commentary I'm going to share with you called The New Authoritarians, How Professors Are Now Calling for Biden to Simply Defy the Supreme Court. Quote, below is my column in The Hill on the call for professors for President Joe Biden to simply defy the Supreme Court and decide for itself what is constitutional and what is not. Here's the column. I shall resist any illegal federal court order. When, quote, the court's interpretation of the Constitution is egregiously wrong, end quote, the president should refuse to follow it. Those two statements were made roughly 60 years apart. The first is from segregationist Alabama Governor George Wallace, and the second was made by two liberal professors this month. In one of the most chilling developments in our history, the left has come to embrace the authoritarian language and logic of segregationists in calling for defiance and radical measures against the Supreme Court. In a recent open letter, Harvard Law professor Mark Thushnet and San Francisco State University political scientist Aaron Belkin called upon President Joe Biden to defy rulings of the Supreme Court that he considers, quote, mistaken in the name of, quote, popular constitutionalism. Thus, in light of the court's bar on the use of race in college admissions, they argue that Biden should just continue to follow his own constitutional interpretation. The use of the affirmative action case is ironic since polls have consistently shown that the majority of the public does not support the use of race in college admissions. Indeed, even in the most liberal states, such as California, voters have repeatedly rejected affirmative action in college administrations. Polls further show that a majority support the Supreme Court's recent decisions. So despite referenda and polls showing majority support for barring race in admission, academics are pushing to impose their own values, regardless of the views of the public or the courts. However, even if these measures were popular, it would not make them right. It is precisely what segregationists such as Senator John Eastland, Democrat of Mississippi, argued that, quote, all the people of the South are in favor of segregation, and the Supreme Court or no Supreme Court, we're going to maintain segregated schools, end quote. Tushnet and Belkin cite with approved approval Biden's declaration that this is, quote, not a normal Supreme Court, end quote. Biden's view of normalcy appears to be a court that agrees with his fluid view of constitutional law, by which we can forgive roughly $500 billion in loans or impose a net national eviction moratorium without a vote of Congress. Tushnet and Belkin know their audience. Biden has previously evidenced little respect for the Constitution or the courts. Take the eviction case. In an earlier decision, a majority of justices had declared that Biden's actions were unconstitutional, confirming what many of us had said for months. Even after the majority declared it unconstitutional, Biden wanted to reissue the national moratorium. White House counsel and most scholars told him the move would be blatantly unconstitutional and defy the express ruling of the court. Instead, he consulted the only law professor willing at that time to tell him what he wanted to hear, and did it anyway. And it was quickly again declared unconstitutional. Other commentators and academics have gone from implied to open contempt for our constitutional norms. Georgetown University Law School professor Rosa Brooks was celebrated for her appearance on MSNBC's The Readout after declaring that Americans are, quote, slaves to the U.S. Constitution, that the Constitution itself is now the problem for the country. MSNBC commentator Eli Mistel called the U.S. Constitution trash and argued that we should simply just dump it. Representative Alexandria Cortez has questioned the need for a Supreme Court. In a New York Times column, quote, the Constitution is broken and should not be reclaimed, law professors Ryan Doffler of Harvard and Samuel Moyne of Yale called for the Constitution to be, quote, radically altered, quote, to reclaim America from constitutionalism. So the danger is now constitutionalism as opposed to what Tushnet and Belkin call popular constitutionalism. Many have called for the court to be packed with liberal appointees to bring it back to what Biden views as normal. Some of these calls before Biden's Supreme Court commission echoed the same views as Tushnet and Belkin. Indeed, they cite Harvard professor Nicholas Bowie, who rejected the notion that the, quote, constitutional interpretation held by a majority of Supreme Court justices should be superior to the interpretations held by majorities of other branches, end quote. The framers saw the Supreme Court as playing a counter-majoritism rule when it was necessary to protect individual rights and constitutional norms. The alternative is what the framers viewed as a tyranny of the majority, where popularity rather than principle prevails. For that reason, the court has often stood with the least popular in our society, and since Marbury versus Madison, has had the final word on what the Constitution means. Justice Robert Jackson once observed that he and his colleagues, quote, are not final because we are infallible. We are infallible because we are final, end quote. That finality has been essential to the stability of our system for generations. While presidents such as Andrew Jackson taunted the court for its inability to enforce its rulings without an army, it has never needed one. Respect for the court is in our DNA. No matter our disagreements with a given decision, Americans will not tolerate defiance of the institution in the rule of law. That is why, despite the support for court packing by many law professors, including Tushnet, Belkin, and Bowie, the public remains staunchly opposed to it. What is most striking about these professors is how they continue to claim they are defenders of democracy, yet seek to use unilateral executive authority to defy the courts, and in cases like the tuition forgiveness and affirmative action, the majority of the public. They remain the privileged elite of academia, declaring their views and values as transcending both constitutional and democratic processes. The problem is indeed constitutionalism, and their view of popular constitutionalism is a euphemism for popular justice. So, good for him. I would agree with that. Because think of it this way. What have we learned recently? And I've been emphasizing that with special clips of congressional hearings under oath that were denied for the past 20 to 25 years. When was the last time a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee or the House Intelligence Group, and they've got a lot of members, and they meet regularly with the CIA and all the national security agencies and the national security overseer. When was the last time a single person within our federal government who has the authority to stop something from happening that is immoral or illegal has done so? When was the last time a single legislator in both Republican or Democratic sides in the Senate or House chose to call someone out for regime change, for the illegal war in Yugoslavia under the Clintons, for the illegal war in Syria, for the illegal war in Yemen, for the illegal war and the regime change in Honduras, or the illegal war that the United States precipitated by supporting the coup back in 2014 in Ukraine, and at least 40 others, not once, not one time. And what about the 51 tops of the intelligence agencies, the 17 intelligence agencies, when they all wrote a letter saying that the Hunter Biden laptop looks like a Russian ploy? Not one of them had actually reviewed the laptop, which had already been confirmed years ago as authentic. As I mentioned yesterday, there are hundreds of crimes that could be prosecuted, including the Mann Act, transporting prostitutes for pay across state lines. Anyone else not in power who committed these crimes would have been sentenced. As I mentioned recently, we have three forms of justice. Let us be clear on this. If you doubt this, if you want to challenge it, please do so. I welcome all challenges. My number is 888-874-4888. The first justice is common justice. If you or I, for example, steal something out of a store, if I were to go in, or you were to go in, anyone in this audience were to go into Dorman, the big store, or let's say Tiffany or Cartier, and you were to take a hammer and break open a case and take some jewelry and walk out the store, if you were arrested, you would end up going to jail. But tens of thousands of shoplifting crimes have been committed. The small business people who've been rude have not been reimbursed a penny. And in fact, in one case, a woman working at Lowe's, she'd been there for a long time, she saw three young people come in and try to steal $2,000 worth of merchandise, and she went over to try to stop them. They laughed and just beat her to a pulp. You'll see her face all black and blue and cut and eyes bulging. Lowe's fired her because it's not their policy to interfere. So now, what does that say to the 3,000 gang members and the untold number? There's no accurate toll on how many gangs members exist. We only can count the gang members who've been arrested in jail. But that's a tiny minority of those that don't get arrested. And they have a constant members joining them. I would guesstimate up around 3 million. These are not stupid people. Their actions may seem cruel and abhorrent, and especially the gangbangers, but they're parasites. They're going to go where they have a weak host. San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Philadelphia, Detroit, Milwaukee, also Chicago and Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Atlanta. Why? Because we've taken what should be a common law. Shoplifting is wrong, morally, but also it's illegal. Now, the fact that you put a mount on that, like the stupid people in San Francisco did in their legislature and their policing body, and say, well, you can steal up to $950, still misdemeanor, no one's going to do anything with you, and we're not even going to stop you. But store owner, if you lay a hand on someone walking out with $900 worth of merchandise, you can be arrested and go to jail. In fact, you probably will be. So, what does that mean? It sends a big message. Open for business. Dirty business. Illegal business. To the gangs and opportunists. Now, is this the average person? Absolutely not. Are they a significant portion of the American population? Absolutely not. The average American is a decent, law-abiding person that wants to see justice presented equally, but it isn't. And now it's all political. So that's a system of justice that is perverse against the average person, but not against the criminals. The second stage is if you're a corporation. Let's say that you're a Merck, and you create a product called Vioxx, a painkiller, and it works. It's a good product, except during testing, they found that it can cause an increase in heart attacks and strokes. Well, that's not good. And there was a person at the FDA who I filmed, and he's in one of my films, where he said that when he found out that there was a substantial increase in heart attack and stroke, he tried to get the FDA to stop this product, and they wouldn't. Complicity between the FDA makes its money from drug sales and the manufacturer. So for 4 years, this drug was sold to countless Americans, and then the heart attacks and strokes added up. Now here's the deception. At least a minimum of 60,000 Americans died in a four-year period using their drug. Now, by the way, the Vietnam War officially was 8 years, all right? But unofficially, it was 12 years. And we had 58,000 deaths. So in 4 years, half the time of the Vietnam War, we killed more people with one drug. All right? But the bad part was that they settled for around more or less $5 billion. They earned $12 billion. They got to keep all their gains. You know, you never see a bank robber saying, "So you caught me. I get to keep what I stole, right?" No. Anytime you have ill-gotten gains, they're confiscated by the state. But not this time. They, in all these cases, including OxyContin, they got to keep it. So now the stock goes up. Wall Street is happy. Investors are happy. Stakeholders are happy. They don't care about the 60,000 people that died, but that's a fallacy. There were not 60,000 people died because they did no extensive tests. What happens when you survive your first heart attack and stroke? So you're not dead, but a year later you are, and no one's counting. No one's including those statistics. I filmed a professor of medicine who teaches doctors, and he himself had to retire. I filmed him outside of his lawn where he had a for sale sign because he couldn't sustain his home. So he had to sell his home after 30 years of being a professor and a medical doctor, and because he was terrified of having a second or third heart attack and stroke. And none of those figures were ever accumulated. So look at the average life expectancy of someone who has a first heart attack and a first stroke of how many go on to have a second or third, and it's fatal. So we could be looking realistically around 500,000 dead, and yet no justice. And that's Biden's justice. That's Biden's Justice Department. That's the Democrat and Republican and corporate justice system. Is that fair? And I could give you, are you ready for this? I hired two young lawyers just out of law school for a year. And the request was, find me every lawsuit that has been settled by a major corporation, and I'm only taking two corporation types of corporations, those on Wall Street and those on Big Pharma. There are over 400,000 lawsuits settled for tens of billions of dollars. Not a single person went to jail. No one lost their reputation. Well, how about that? That's a pretty good system. Did they lose their charter? Shouldn't you revoke a charter so the corporation has to dissolve itself and all the stakeholders, don't get to continue on? Because these are serial offenders. In fact, one of the companies making your vaccines has repeatedly violated the law, causing deaths, and yet not a question about their integrity when it came to making the vaccine. Well, now A lot of people have buyer's remorse. I just counseled someone last night. In fact, someone very, very, very famous last night. One of the family is one of the founders of a major Wall Street firm, and about a kid, and the doctors cannot figure out why this kid is so sick. And I said, that's not normal for a four-year-old kid. I said, surely they didn't give the four-year-old vaccines. Silence. Yeah, they did. All the vaccines. Okay. Now we have an understanding of what we have to look for and to go forward to try to detoxify this kid before the kid dies, because orthodox medicine has nothing in their armamentarium they can help with. So is that justice? No, it isn't. Will anyone go to jail for all the crimes against humanity? Bill Gates, anyone? Anthony Fauci? No, it won't. Not as long as the deep state's involved. So that's our second justice. If you're rich and powerful, you can buy attorneys. What if you're not rich or famous? Then you cut a deal. What if you're innocent? You still cut a deal. So you go from a felony to a misdemeanor to a minor misdemeanor, but then they've got a notch on their belt, and that's how it works. But then there's a third form of justice, and that is what happens if you are a major player in, let's say, the intelligence agencies. Of all the millions and millions of people who've died because of the CIA and the FBI and Homeland Security and other agencies or regime changes around the world, mainly the CIA, how many people have gone to jail? How many people have been arrested? Well, you see right now how they totally protected, lied, engaged in every illegal activity imaginable to protect Hunter Biden, because if they got to Hunter Biden, they're going to go after Joe Biden. And that testimony is coming this coming Monday. And that should pretty much do it. Now, they'll still try to defend him, but that's not going to work. But still, no intelligence agency has been decommissioned. We don't need them anyhow. They're terrorist organizations. No one has been punished. So you kill someone in the through the CIA, you get away with it. Right? You get away with everything, no matter what your crime. Unaccountable. They're totally a rogue state, as is the FBI, as we've seen. So we have justice. Now, these same constitutional elite lawyers at Yale and Harvard and other places, they don't want the Constitution. They want their own justice system by the majority control they have. What kind of justice and perversion of that notion would happen if we, the public, had no say-so, if we had no one defending the true merits of consequences of breaking the law? We would have a total police state, fully authoritarian, and these people would be the ones controlling it. So good for you, Jonathan Turley. Thank you for standing up for the rest of us. And the corporate elite and those within that community who want to trash the Constitution, well, not yet. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are Jonathan and Maya's opinions. You can call in and share your points of view. But show where I'm wrong. Show me if you commit the same crime the CIA does, that you will be not held accountable. Oh, you will. Then suddenly have a CIA or FBI badge, and you won't. And that's the way it works. Otherwise, an awful lot of famous people, including people you voted for, would be in prison for the rest of their lives. That said, let's go to something that gives us some enlightenment on all this. I'm going to play a clip now. It's very short, and listen very carefully, because this is a former World Economic Forum global leader for tomorrow, like Trudeau, top of the class. But he says something that now he's perceived as a whistleblower. He's economic professor Richard Werner, and he describes how, according to his sources, the CBDCs, the cashless society, will ultimately be stored on small microchips implanted under your skin, and universal basic income will be offered as the bribe to get you to say, yeah, hey, a little grain of rice under my skin. I'm up for it. You're going to give me £2,000 or $2,500 a month. I'm up for that. I don't have to work. No, you don't have to work. But everything you need, we're going to know about. Okay. Think this is a joke? Think this is not planned? Listen to him. Mind you, he is a World Economic Forum global leader for tomorrow. Just like Trudeau, just like Obama, just like Merkel. Yet he told us the truth. Here's the truth. Listen carefully.
They have literally delayed their agenda because I think it's so important to them. They've been very careful about the timing, and let's wait a little longer, let's have this crisis first, or let's have COVID first, you know, soften them up. But they've delayed because the technology was already ready around 2015 to roll out. Mm-hmm. And what people don't mention is, what do these CBDCs actually look like, you know? At the moment, there's a bit of talk about this being phone-based apps. And yes, that is the initial phase. But what was already ready around 2015 is the ultimate goal, what they really want. Apparently, I was told by a central banker, is, you know, CBDCs looks like a small grain of rice that they want to put under your skin, which is, in my view, a violation of human dignity. And they realize there is a hurdle. So to get people to accept this, there will be, you know, why suddenly are all the billionaires saying, let's have universal basic income? Because the story is going to be, oh, now we've created this vast unemployment and disruption and crises. Well, we need universal basic income. You will get 2,000 euros into your account every month. But of course, to run this efficiently, we need to use the latest technology. So, you know, you need the CBDC chip implant. But how many people will say, okay, fine, 2,000 pounds, 2,000 euros, you know?
A surprising proportion.
He is absolutely correct. Look how many people did not question the safety and efficacy, just assume that whatever they were told was correct and took the vaccines. We're now seeing the obituaries. We're seeing people every day struggle with pain and physical disability. We're seeing people who don't know if they should play sports now because of the scarring of their heart, which is neither temporary nor minor. It will ultimately kill you, a myocarditis. And that doesn't even include the self-regulating nanolipid particles that we're finding in people's veins, leading to this, you know, the graphite in the vein, microcirculatory system causing these blood clots. So you see, we've been lied to, and yet there's been no outcry at all for hearings or justice thus far. Even to question this in official Washington, look at Robert Kennedy, pro-vaccine on every vaccine in history, challenges this one, and suddenly the entire Democratic organization loses its mind. Well, it won't matter that they're found guilty and wrong. What matters is those of you who are smart enough at this point to stop trusting anyone in authority or power until you do your own homework and see they deserve your trust. Who handles our food? When you're eating something, do you have any concept of why it costs so much? The average American is actually paying about 22% more for everything. So inflation is not 6.8% or 7.4%. No, it's over 20%. But nobody wants to acknowledge that. A lot of it has to do with food. Here's a short clip about the, quote, evil companies owns all the food in your house. The classroom for second thought. Let's go to the clip.
There's blood on the hands of the Packers and leaders in Washington, and no one seems to care. I know we live in a country where capitalism reigns supreme, and it's every man for himself, but Packers take capitalism to a whole new level.
They've been called the worst company in the world. They once had an intelligence operation bigger than the CIA, and they have near complete control over how and what you eat. Cargill Incorporated is the biggest privately owned company in America by a huge margin. They bring in more money than the third, fourth, and fifth largest companies combined. Pretty much any food you buy, they make a little bit of money off of. This is a result of over a century of consolidation, absorbing, buying up, and merging with other companies to try to control a chunk of every aspect of the food economy.
Cargill's Allburger brand salts.
Plant proteins.
Asphalt rejuvenator.
Super chicken, I do up yung jin mo so ka tang.
Partially hydrogenated product.
A very, very special treat.
Their power and breadth have kept wages down, squashed worker power, and pushed family farms to the brink of non-existence, while manipulating prices for the consumer. That's you. And that ubiquity is about to get even worse. Cargill has plans to absorb a chicken empire. It's all made one family very, very rich. The Cargill McMillans own 88% of the company. 14 of them are billionaires. The family is worth a total of $40 billion. How does so much wealth get concentrated into so few hands? To answer that, we have to go back 127 years to the beginnings of Cargill's history. This is The Classroom by More Perfect Union, and today we're going to look at how the Cargills got rich. Cargill began in 1865, right as the Civil War ended, with the purchase of a single grain storage warehouse. As the then new railroad expanded along the American West, Cargill facilities followed. At the time, the Cargills didn't really own farms or actually produce anything. They just weaseled themselves into grain profits by controlling infrastructure and storage. Then, as one of the first clues the family treats real life like Game of Thrones,
one flesh, one heart, one soul, now and forever,
W.W. Cargill married off his daughter Edna to John H. McMillan, whose family owned even more grain warehouses. The companies merged. They became the Cargill McMillans, the family we know today. By the early 1900s, Cargill controlled so much different industry that if a grain farmer in the Midwest didn't do business with Cargill, they couldn't do business at all. World War I breaks out, and Cargill makes a profit. They started expanding out of the Midwest, building out what they internally called the Endless Belt. Picture a giant, nation-spanning conveyor belt hauling wheat from a farm in western Iowa. It stops at a mill facility in Chicago to become flour, the flour goes to a bakery in Pittsburgh where it's turned into a Kaiser roll, and then it lands at a New York City deli to become a delicious Reuben. Cargill's plan was to make money at each step of the way, selling seed and supplies to the farmer, storing the grain, selling tools to the mill, sourcing sesame seeds for the bakery, and selling curing salt to the deli. Oh, and they own the transportation systems too. The further it goes, the more they make. In 1924, they acquired the Taylor and Bornique Company, a competitor, who had a unique technology, a private wire system. Back then, this was the equivalent of having your own internet.
Now that I've gotten on the internet, I'd rather be on my computer than doing just about anything.
The tech was so good, it remained in operation till 1996, well into the internet age. Getting good information quickly was important, because Cargill was beginning to work in commodities futures trading. That's gambling on the future prices of necessities like wheat, corn, and meat. A lot of this business is done at the Chicago Board of Trade, which was basically a real version of how you pictured the stock market as a kid. A bunch of guys yelling in a room about the price of a bushel of wheat. Novelist Frank Norris wrote in his The Epic of the Wheat, "Think of it, the food of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people just at the mercy of a few men down there at the Board of Trade. They make the price. They say just how much the peasant shall pay for his loaf of bread. If he can't pay the price, he simply starves." Cargill established information superiority. If they got information about something that could affect wheat prices at one location, they could instantly blast that information to other locations and change how they invest. This is one of the ways consolidation helps. Because Cargill had so many business arms, they got all the best information all of the time. Sounds a lot like insider trading, right? In commodities trading, that's basically legal. In contrast to stocks, commodities trading is the only major US market where companies are allowed to act on inside information to manage risks others might not know about. In fact, that is how futures markets were designed. This is how Cargill managed to profit off the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. The Dust Bowl was caused in large part by the too quick expansion of agriculture into the American prairie by companies like Cargill. Farmers changed the landscape of the area too quickly, and the ecosystem couldn't handle it. The Great Depression was caused in large part by speculation, again, a Cargill practice. Cargill, of course, had a different idea of whose fault the Depression was. CEO John McMillan Sr. blamed the labor movement. They got entirely out of hand and demanded to reduce the number of hours worked to 40 hours a week. It is making the cost of everything so great that neither the farmer nor anyone else can live. The Depression sent grain prices down, and the Dust Bowl sent them up. Cargill profited both times. Their intelligence network had predicted the corn shortage and stockpiled it, and people noticed. For the first time, there were attempts to regulate the Cargill model of business. The Chicago Board of Trade banned Cargill. New Deal programs attempted to slow consolidation and regulate speculation, but Cargill executives argued against those programs to the public and FDR administration officials, saying the government should be cutting costs on labor instead. Their lobbying worked, and the Department of Agriculture agreed to a plan that gave the grain trading industry almost complete control over regulating themselves. In the following decades, they bought more and more companies, from other agriculture businesses to seemingly random endeavors like Las Vegas casinos and Tokyo Love hotels. Significantly, they've also taken over much of the meat industry. There are four big meat companies: Tyson, JBS, National Beef, and Cargill, which collectively control 85% of the world's meat. They decide the prices, they decide the supply, they decide what we eat and how much we pay for it. And despite these companies using the illusion of inflation to raise prices, they think they're helping.
You can't have a bunch of small players delivering such an important food source to the nation's consumers. You have to have larger companies that can do it cheaply and can keep costs down.
All of that consolidation has made a massive corporation that's still privately owned, 88% by the Cargill-McMillan family, and doesn't have to report anything to the public. These days, the family isn't as involved in the direct management of the company as they used to be. They still dominate the board, but the executives are outsiders. But they still make an income off the company. Dividends are payments corporations mete out to shareholders periodically. The Cargills got paid $1.13 billion in dividends in 2020. That's 44,000 times what the average American family farm made the same year. Cargill Inc. and the Cargill-McMillan family aren't one and the same, but the fiduciary responsibility of the company is to make money for the family. And they're only getting more powerful. The family and the company are major beneficiaries of a pro-corporate government. When Cargill was accused of having child slaves in the Ivory Coast, the Supreme Court dropped the case because the statute that allowed foreigners to sue in American court couldn't be used to sue corporations. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000 took away what limited regulations over speculative commodities we had, which led to Cargill opening up hedge funds that invested in commodity futures. They were selling people investments in a market they controlled. And they want to get even bigger. Cargill recently completed a merger with Sanderson Chicken, the third largest chicken producer in America.
Our customers and also consumers, they want to eat more chicken.
A coalition of senators had implored the Department of Justice to investigate and stop it. This mega merger, in a sector already plagued with consolidation and illegal behaviors that harm farmers and consumers alike, represents a new threat to building a competitive agricultural industry. But the DOJ allowed the deal to go through with one caveat. The combined companies would stop using the tournament system, where top-performing workers got bonuses taken from the paychecks of lower performers, a practice enabled by consolidation.
Just 2 days after this announcement, I was handed a pay cut. In this take-it-or-leave-it relationship with Sanderson, they told me that they were going to reduce my income by one-third. And whether or not I signed this pay contract, that all Sanderson growers, only within the state of Mississippi, would receive this pay cut.
It's easier to treat your employees poorly when the guy across town does too. The companies also had to pay a fine, $85 million total. That's almost nothing to the vast wealth of the Cargills. That wealth was hoarded at the expense of small farmers, working people, people who eat food, and people who simply live on Earth. Cargill is one of the worst polluters in the world. At least a portion of the Cargill's $40 billion was taken from you. The rise of the Cargill Corporation and the wealth hoarding of the few dozen family members benefiting from it shows that aggressive consolidation in any industry is bad for working people and needs to be regulated. Thank you for watching, and don't forget to like and subscribe.
Okay. We'll be covering. Okay, I just wanted to share information that can empower you by knowing where your food comes from and why we don't have a country that decentralizes food production and emphasizes and supports locally grown organic and sustainable agriculture that also protects the land and our waterways and runoff from pig farms and dairy farms, and that then causes eutrophication in the Gulf of Mexico. So bad is it that when I went down there to film it, And I've been to New Orleans many times, beautiful, especially the French Quarter, beautiful place, wonderful people. And you can walk from the French Quarter across the street, you're at the Mississippi. And then you've got the bridge and you're right at the mouth of the Mississippi. And you'll see the water change color. It's very turgid, very dark, and nothing lives in that because there's no oxygen in the water. That's why it's called a dead zone. And that's one of the largest dead zones in the Gulf. Where's that come from? Comes from all the communities, the farming communities, going clear up through, clear up to Canada. So why can't we change that? Well, because single companies have become monopolies. Well, don't we have any trust busters? Don't we have anyone in a position to stop companies and continue to merge and be even stronger and richer? No, we do not. It's a joke. And we do not. We had 1,300 media companies 30 years ago. Now we have 7 that control radio, television, and newsprint. And that's unfortunate. So that's one of the problems. Now, if you'd like to call in and share your opinions on any of this thing that I'm talking about, please do so. 888-874-4888. Let me mention why we're still on with BAI for another 3 minutes before they go to the news. We're going to continue to the top of the hour at PRN.live. Tonight, I'm going to be doing a debate on the Progressive Commentary Hour with a very articulate and extremely educated person on a topic that impacts all of us. And she is a top of her class at Yale University, then a fellow with a big reward over at Cambridge University in Great Britain, then graduate also from Stanford University without a lot of discipline. I'm sure that that person will bring their best game. But if you've ever heard me debate, if you ever watched me race, I'm almost always the last person to go out in a race. If you ever listen to me interviewing people, I let them talk. I want to know what they're saying, the content and context. And then I listen. And like Muhammad Ali, because I don't interrupt someone every time I consider they've made a mistake and jump on it, I don't look at debating as a blood sport. I look at it as a way of people sharing different points of view, but let them talk so whatever their view is, you hear it. And I try to keep it cordial and thoughtful. But I'll save my strength and my insights for the end. Remember that. All right? When you hear the debate tonight, some people are going to say, Gary, this person, go after it. No, I won't. And since the last 34 years, I have not lost a race. Out of hundreds and hundreds of championships and world games and national championships, regional, because I don't go out and try to get to the front. I don't never do that. No, you have to be very patient and measured. Save it for the end, like Muhammad Ali and Zaire fighting George Foreman. Everyone thought he had lost till the last round. So that's tonight, 7 o'clock. Very important topic. And I'm sure this person, and if they say something that I agree with, I'll compliment them. I'll say, well said. You know, and then, but we'll see what happens by the end. We're continuing on now, and if we have anyone on, I'd like to hear from them.
We have Joe from Queens.
Hi, Joe from Queens. Your turn.
Yeah. Hi, Gary. I called several months ago about 3 things I felt that I appreciated and felt indebted to you for. I don't know if you recall that.
I do.
Yeah, and they were, just to remind, yeah, first of all, the knowledge, the vast amount of knowledge on health science that you share. Number 2 is a friend of mine who was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer 10 years ago. He worked with the nurse you work with, Luann, and not only is he still alive, but he's doing better than ever. And the 3rd thing was I credit you with helping me to become a better, more objective thinker. And that story actually is a long story, and maybe I could tell it some other time because I know we're at the end of the show. But It has to do with something you said years ago, probably in the 90s, about the radio host Bob Grant, and then how I incorporated what you said into my psychedelic mushroom sessions, and how I was able to imprint a new way of thinking. So, sometime maybe I'd like to talk to you about it.
That's fine. I appreciate your call. Thank you. If there's a takeaway message from that call, it is that if you only look at one way of healing, and if that way works, that's very good. But what if it doesn't? What if, because of politics and profits, controlling the protocols for economic gain and monopolizing a particular field like oncology, that you overlook things that are simpler, Occam's razor, something that will detoxify the body, like garlic and onions, cruciferous vegetables with their isothiocyanates and indole-3-carbinols and their sulfur that really is great at killing off viruses, turning off inflammation, and helping to neutralize cancer cells. Well, that is too simple, and here is the message on that. And this is the message I shared back in, it was not in the 1990s, the 1980s, when I did a series of lectures called Mastering Life, one per week for 2 years, or over 100 lectures in that series. And I've never shown those, but I am, in the next year, I'm going to be editing those into current topics and putting them up on my website. In any case, what is the message? That because something seems too simple to be effective, because we've confused the complexity of a problem and all of its dynamics of complexity, that we can't imagine something simple to work, whether it's in our thoughts. For example, if I'm living in a neighborhood, well, once was a great neighborhood, but now it isn't, I have some choices. I can change my place where I live. I can ask other people to, let's get to the root problem of why this neighborhood is in decline. But what if a neighborhood is part of a city, the whole city's in decline, like San Francisco or Los Angeles? Then you have little enclaves. You have your group of people who are rich and powerful, and they have private security and armed guards, and no one can put a tent in front of their home. It'll be taken down, and versus everyone else. Well, if a wealthy person, a powerful person, no longer can think and act in a way that also supports the same virtue of living as you, a common person, a regular person, then they're living a delusion, because the fact they can live in a place where they're inside, they're safe, and negate anything that's happening outside, then you're looking at a society in decline. You're looking at a people in decline. You're looking at self-absorbed and selfish narcissists who are having undue control over a whole system, and in which case that system has got to collapse, in which case you move on to a place that is more humane, more fertile for ideas, positive suggestions, better quality of life, safe quality of life. And that means making a move to more rural areas. The gangs don't want to go to rural America because people are armed and there's not the riches there to steal. But the cities, yes, it's getting worse. But what happens is we maladapt to it. We just, you know, what happened today? Nothing. So no. One guy, you know, is swinging a baseball bat at everyone. But I just, you know, walked across the street. Nope. Did you deal with it? No, I didn't deal with anything. No, I saw a guy get his throat cut. Another guy got shot. And I saw a lot of people running out of a store carrying all the stuff they could steal. Did you say anything? What am I going to do? No. That's a person living in complete denial. Now, if they're living in that kind of denial over their physical well-being, quality of life, and the aesthetics of their existence, imagine what kind of nihilism they're bringing to every other part of their life and everyone in that life. So that's the takeaway message that I believe our guest just now was explaining made a difference in his life. And as a result, there's a person using our protocols that is alive and well with stage 4 colorectal cancer, one of those challenging cancers to reverse, but it was reversed, but not by orthodoxy. They tried and they failed. I remember the case. Okay? So don't think that everything has to come from the Orthodox mindset. It doesn't. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. Now remember, today at 5 o'clock, you can hear Utrecht Lead. And right now, we're going to our next program. Have a nice day.